Tonight, the Bullock Performance Institute live and interactive series continues with a performance by the world-class flutist Amy Porter, who is here in the studio with me today, along with Professor of Flute at Western Michigan University, Martha Council Vargas. I'd like to welcome you to WMUK and thank you for taking some time out of your day to talk about the program with me.
Thank you for hosting me.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
I know you're both very, very busy as professors as well as performers, but we're going to focus on the performing aspect today. Amy, this is the first time we've met, but your reputation very much precedes you. We have a number of your recordings in our library, and you are one of the most prominent flutists performing today. Could I hear about, when you were coming up, who were the most prominent flutists in your day that really influenced you as a performer?
Well, for me, it would have to be Jean-Pierre Rampal and James Galway, because they brought the medium of flute performance to the public and made it popular, and then everyone wanted to play the flute. So I'm sure we all know someone who plays the flute. Whether it's just in their, whether it's just in their home or by the lake or in a major concert hall or in their community or teaching in their settlement music school, it's really important that we continue the legacy of Rampal and Sir James Galway.
I would fully agree. They were kind of the two pillars of that time.
And they were.
Did you have any people to throw in as well, Martha?
You know, it's funny you ask, because I was just thinking about when was the first time I knew about Amy Porter, and I'm pretty sure I was 13 years old, Amy, oh. And you were on the cover of Flute Talk magazine, and I must say, Amy's one of my all-time favorite players, and that is true. In addition to Leon Bicey, my teacher, Michel DeBose, and of course, Sir James and Jean-Pierre Rampal, those were two of the first flutists I ever heard.
You're not alone. Many flutists kind of treasure your playing, Amy.
Oh, and, my goodness, thank you.
Martha even admitted to listening to some of your Bach earlier and a feeling, kind of an inexpressible emotion, was it?
I don't know if I ever told you this, Amy, but when you played Bach cello, your transcription of Bach cello suite,
yes,
whenever it was, 2 years ago,
yes,
in Seattle when we first met,
oh, yeah,
I did actually weep in the audience.
As we all do to that amazing cello suite. Well, I'm glad it caught you, because that's my job as a performer, is to reach deep inside myself to access whatever you have going on inside yourself. And that's what is also great about live music, is that it's not a one-way experience. It's definitely a two-way street. I have to say I learned a lot from the orchestral flutists of our country, but also the string players. Yo-Yo Ma, there is no one else as inspiring. Leontine Price, when she would walk on the stage, I wouldn't breathe for 5 minutes. Friederike von Stade, Jesse Norman, the big divas of our time. I studied the way they walked. I studied the way they almost invited you, and they crooked their finger and said, come hither, you know, and they said, listen to this, and then listen to this, and this is my story. And it's almost like a movie, right? You're watching and listening, but really, you're just staring at this human on the stage who better do their job, which is rivet you. So I studied a lot more than just Sir James and Rampal. Now, I have to say, when I started the flute, it was early 70s. It was, about 1974, 5. Mm-hmm. And that we didn't have access to anything but the recordings, the records, right? And cassette tapes and things like that.
Eventually.
So we stocked up on those. And so who was recording but James Galway and Rampal? So
that's quite a margin.
Why.
Yeah.
But then my ears opened to William Bennett. My ears opened to the European Alain Marion and Peter Lucas Graff, whom I ended up studying with to get a little bit of their spice in my playing. So I attribute a lot of the way that I teach, which is very descriptive and conceptual, to the European method of teaching.
So where were you growing up at this time?
Wilmington, Delaware, 30 minutes and 25 miles outside of Philadelphia. So I would go to the Philadelphia Orchestra once a month with my parents, my dad worked for DuPont, but he was also a private piano teacher. And he had played the trumpet in the U.S. Army. So he was my parents were very musical and amateur but I think sometimes the volunteer and the amateur is a lot more passionate sometimes than the professional.
That's
I think,
true.
Yes, right. So I think that with them taking me to the Philadelphia Orchestra, letting me sing in the Northern Delaware Oratorio Society, I sang Beethoven Ninth Symphony when I was 15. My mother begged the conductor, could she please sing in German? She won't make a mistake. She promised. She said, Amy, you have to just sing phonetically. You know. So Beethoven 9 at age 15, playing in the Youth Orchestra of Greater Philadelphia and being in front of the great artists at the Academy of Music in Philly, studying woodwind quintet and, oh my gosh, ear training. And I couldn't have asked for a better upbringing.
Yeah. It really speaks to the institutions supporting young artists and allowing these opportunities to happen where an indelible experience alters the path or puts a young player on a path. You mentioned Europe, going to Europe to study. Where was this again?
Well, this was through the Delaware Austrian American Society.
Oh.
So I would do the competition, and some years I wouldn't win. But the year that I did win, I got to go, and I was 20. And you get to go for 6 weeks and live by yourself with a Hausfrau and a bunch of other kids that play in the Mozarteum Academy, and you get to walk to school and meet some of the best friends and listen to these great teachers. And I'll never forget one wonderful story is that I played a sonatine by Henri Dutilleux, French composer, and I thought I was pretty good in my class there in Salzburg at the Mozarteum. And Alain Marion said, Amy, that was great. Now let's everybody, we're going to go out for ice cream. And he took me by the arm and we went to the ice cream stand. I wanted chocolate, but he insisted I have vanilla. We then took the class and sat on there's a little around the Mozarteum, there's a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat by the wall and looked at the flowers, and he talked about how the ice cream was melting down the cone. And I'm wondering, wow, why am I getting such special treatment? So I go back into the class, and I sit in the back room thinking I'm finished. But no, he says, Amy, you must come back and play Dutilleux again, this time with ice cream and sunshine.
Oh, I was afraid that he was going to use vanilla as a negative.
No, he wanted the sugar, the spice, the beauty that I had just experienced and noticing the melting of the cone and noticing all these amazing things. And then I could put them into my music. He could have said, play shorter on this note. He could have said, play faster on this run. He could have said anything, but he took me out for ice cream.
Maybe a picture and a story just engages more of us,
ourselves in the music. Yes, and that's what my program is tonight. It's called Powerful Images, and Martha chose it. And why did you choose it, Martha?
Well, because I'm a big fan of Powerful Images, and also because there's a sonata called the Western Sonata, and because it includes a couple of my favorite pieces, namely the U Fantasy.
Yes. Well, one thing I want to clarify is that you didn't pick out the pieces on the program. It's just that Ms. Porter offers a variety of evenings.
I do. I offered two programs.
Yeah.
And she said, well, it's obvious. And I hadn't obviously thought of it until she said, it's the Western Sonata in capital letters. So the Western Sonata is the Western Sonata, like it sounds like it's Bronco Buster at the end. Prairie is the second movement. And the Stagecoach is the first movement. So it's truly
it's unbelievably
the Western Michigan. Yeah.
Well, Amy Porter is in concert tonight at 7:30 p.m. with pianist Yulian Te, who has just rejoined our faculty at Western Michigan University, and it's nice to have her back, too. The program is a live and interactive program, and so if you arrive at 7, you'll get to witness a little interaction, a little interview with the soloist on stage and learn a little more about what's behind the music. We'll continue to learn a little more here this hour on WMUK, but let's take a moment for our tea sipping and hear the Georges Hue fantasy. Perhaps you could set up, this is a live performance. Tell us of the circumstances, if you would.
This is the National Concert Hall in Taiwan, Taipei, Taiwan. This is just across the mall from the Chiang Kai-shek Memorial. It's my first debut in Taiwan, and they've been waiting for me to come. So I opened up with a concert called The Whim of Fantasy, and I played three of the most famous fantasies that we have for flute. But I had to play the opening for a fantasy, then I played a Japanese fantasy by Hayashi, and then I ended with U. So this, the U and the Foray were memorized, but the Hayashi was not. So this is me on the third fantasy. I have not left the stage, and I know I have to bring the most famous piece of all time to 1,100 people in the audience. So it was just a really great pleasure to launch into this piece, and I was telling Martha, I took note of myself. I took the control of myself after the first da-da, because I could have really just pushed, and the pitch would have gone sharp, so I had to kind of rein myself in, and it made for a very, very popular download and viewing on YouTube. So
you're saying there's like hundreds of thousands of views on this particular
Thanks,
performance. Yes, and by one of the most famous pieces. This is among flutists one of the standard pieces that everyone studies.
Right, and it was written as a conservatory competition piece.
All right, let's hear it. If you tuned in during the music, that is The Fantasy by Georges Hue, a piece written in 1913 for students at the Paris Conservatory as a final exam piece. It was played by a famous flutist here in the studio today, one who shakes her head whenever she hears famous, but Amy Porter is one of the highest regarded flute players we have today, and she's performing tonight at 7:30 p.m. in the Dalton Center Recital Hall at Western Michigan University as part of the Bullock Performance Institute Live and Interactive Series. It is a ticketed event, tickets available at the door or through the Miller Auditorium box office. And Amy, let's talk a little about you as a professor of flute at the University of Michigan, where you're visiting us from. How long have you held that position?
I've been there for 18 years.
So you're very at home at that school.
Then. Yes, and they're at home with me.
And it's up to you to build a studio that fine musicians are attracted to and want to learn from you in this environment. So if you go back 18 years, how did you figure that all out?
I was also on a track to be a soloist, and I was sitting in a major symphony orchestra, unhappy. And the old adage, love what you do and do what you love, was becoming confused. It was becoming, the waters were muddy, the path to my through my heart wasn't clear. And so when a recent grad of the University of Michigan waved a piece of paper in front of me saying, Would you ever audition for this job? I said, why would I ever want that? And he said, because they wonder what's wrong with your career if you hang out in Ann Arbor too long. They really want you to run around the world and say Michigan. And I thought, okay, I went to Juilliard. I don't quite understand that, but I can do that. And so I went for the interview, and everything was just like it should have been. And my, it wasn't easy, but it was one of the best auditions and interview experiences. And when I arrived, I think as in every great job, if you continue to do what you know how to do best and just do it, then people really respect you. If you run around and ask, how am I doing? If you run around and wonder if you're doing okay just because somebody might say something wrong, somebody might say boo, or left or right, go left or right. You know, I think if you just stay your own course, the biggest best advice I could give for anyone starting in a university is do your thing and be humble and smile, say please and thank you. And to get to the heart of your question, I think that the second thing is to make these students great flutists. I think the first thing is to make them nice humans. I can't make them nice humans. So if they come in the door as a nice person, then it all will go well. And they say please and thank you. There's a beautiful line of respect my students have for me and that I have for them. They call me Professor Porter. And that's just great because that's a big tradition at Michigan. And I've been Professor Porter for 18 years. And if I walk down the hall and hear someone calling Amy, I know it's not me. But I've created that Amy Porter flutist as my other great love in my career. So Amy Porter Flutist exists on a different website, and Porter Flute, which is the student's website, Porter Flute exists as Professor Porter. That's a huge website full of downloads and exercises and things like that, articles. Yeah, because the presenters were getting a little confused with all the education, they said. So Amy Porter, flutist, has a different.
So you separated
kind of
like, them.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, now today I'm kind of blending, and which is what I do. I take a whole day and I spend it at the university, and they get me. They get me for meals. They get me for a master class. They get me for sometimes one-on-one lessons, and then a concert,
and a radio
interview. So that's kind of what I'm doing as kind of the a one-day affair, and I'm really loving it. I'm going to Youngstown in the spring, and but same. I'm also playing a Trail of Tears concerto with the Flint Symphony. So there's some great local things I get to do as a professor and as a soloist.
Here's a good chance to talk to you about your relationship with a fellow faculty member who's a composer named Michael Dougherty, who wrote this flute concerto for you. There's a reveal later this hour. It's coming out on CD. We'll give you the details a little bit later. And he just won a Pulitzer. Was it Pulitzer Prize?
A Grammy.
He's
won a Grammy. Okay. He's won a Grammy.
For a different work, but he's very in demand right now.
Yes, he is. And I will single him out, and then I won't single him out. I will say that Michael is an amazing composer and one of my favorites, and yet the composer as a human, I'll say again, as a person, just absolutely enraptures me. I always wonder about what's coming out of their hands. And the great thing about Michael Dougherty as a composer is that he writes idiomatically for the instrument and for the instrumentalist. So that piece took me 7 years to ask him, how's that flute concerto coming? When can I get in the queue? I came in the queue, and we had a couple years to raise the money through a consortium of 10 orchestras. And it was about over a three-year period. One of them was in Carnegie Hall, Zenkel Hall at Carnegie Hall with the American Composers Orchestra. So it's just been a great life to have him write me a concerto. You know, he writes a lot of different people concerti, so I can't say that I'm singled out as just this amazing concerto that he wrote. But I have to say, out of all the concertos he's written, I think it's his best. He loves it. And so it's just an exciting thing. But let me get back to the composers in general. The composer, I mean, which came first, the performance, the performer, or the composer, right? So we have to take what they write for us. They obviously have heard us. They come to us, like Joel Puckett said, I'm writing you a piece. Well, now this piece, Shadow of Sirius, has been played thousands of times by hundreds of flutists. And it was written for me after a heart-wrenching time in his life. So for me to have to sit down at the piano and unearth my own interpretation of a composer's piece is one of the greatest honors that I could have. So for me, the composer is revered, and I try to bring to my performances new works, and they're very, very listenable works as well. So I'm not trying to educate the masses. I'm bringing to you, like tonight, I'm bringing to you Mike DeJumstrom's sonata, and it's about the Transylvania forest in Romania. He brings some Romanian folk songs on it, but Mike was sitting in my flute studio as an accompanist, as a collaborative pianist, as a composer for probably a good 8 years before I ever realized he was so talented. He teaches theory at Curtis now, and he sent me this piece. And usually it's the composer sending me the piece after the premiere. So they say, here's, it's been premiered, which is the proper way to do things. You wait for the premiere, and then you send your piece out. And I'm usually the recipient of some gorgeous pieces. So tonight I'm bringing the students, whom I adore, new music.
That's great.
For them to play.
Yes, they'll be listening intently to see if it sparks something in them and they can study it. And that's, of course, how performance practice works through the centuries. Speaking of concertos for flute, it seemed like when we were both listening as young people, there was a preponderance of the classical and Baroque style and then a big gap in the Romantic era for flute concertos. And then the 20th century started picking back up again. And I imagine, and then I stopped paying as much attention. So I was wondering if you could talk about the last 20 years or so where there's been a big burst, I would think, in available pieces to play. And that is what you were just speaking to, but
well, the universe is available to them.
Yeah.
So we have now a cross-pollination of all kinds of genres, and that's what's happened. I think that it was 40 years ago when, because we lived in the United States, we weren't listening or being, you know, fed, taught those major European, beautiful, romantic sonatas and concerti, although they were around. Mm. So then what happened is we had performers starting to turn to the Fauré violin sonata, the Franck, you know, all these amazing violin pieces, Debussy now, transcribed for flute. So the other direction was that the young composer who also loved dance music or also loved any kind of modern music, they fused their compositions with a genre of that's new to us. And now we have jazz infused, written out flute sonatas that sounds like it's improvised. We have shakuhachi inspired performances and pieces for multiple instruments. And I know my doctoral student is working on an entire concert with a board. So a board that will a digital audio workspace.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
A DAW, right. And she's going to be working with this board, which will delay her sound. She'll be able to improv off of it and then fuse, go into new pieces. Now, that's a little, you know, forward thinking for me. And if I don't, for instance, beatboxing is a big, big trait now. I don't beatbox, but I feel my students can lead me to lead them. So I think, like I said, because we were in America without the internet growing up, and now we have the internet, and now we have the cross-pollination of genres, I think that composition can go everywhere it wants.
My guest is Amy Porter, who performs tonight at 7:30 p.m. She is visiting us from the University of Michigan, where she has been professor of flute for 18 years and is also a major concert artist as Amy Porter. Instead of Professor Porter, she can be heard on concert stages around the country and well beyond that. Music starts at 7:30 and the pre-concert interaction interview begins at 7 p.m. if you come. Tickets are available at the door or through the MillerAuditorium.com box office. I have to admit, Amy, that as we've been talking, I've been looking to cue a piece by Mike Jumstrom, and I have been unable to navigate to that piece of music. So I'm hoping we can talk about the Caliendo, because I can cue that up.
I see, the Western Sonata.
Yes.
We have to talk about the Western Sonata.
But I thought you could give us a few words about this. This looks like a major piece on the program, Beyond the Forest from 2015.
Oh, okay. Yes. Mike wrote it for Jeffrey Kaner, who teaches at the Curtis Institute. Principal of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and also teaches at Juilliard. And he premiered this piece in 2015 in Philadelphia, and subsequently Mike sent it to me. When I started to look at it, I heard some incredible folk songs, but I heard one in particular that I thought was a complete ripoff. And I called him and I said, Mike, I hear a quote from Ligeti, Six Bagatelles. And I sang it to him and he said, I've never heard it. He said, that must be a really authentic Hungarian, Romanian folk song. Because, right, they share a border, yeah. So they cross-pollinated
these themes. Let's call it Transylvanian.
Themes. Yes, Transylvanian, right. And so he blends these amazing folk tunes throughout, and the final piece is a dance. Of course, it gets faster and faster and faster and faster and ends on a triple high E. So he wrote a really great piece. And after that, I have to maybe swab out and have some water and take a pause. Yeah.
And lo and behold, my eyes lit right on it. So we can listen to a little bit of this piece. Let's hear the Andantino, the very first movement.
Yes, it's stunning.
I'm thoroughly teased by the first movement of Beyond the Forest, having a hard time cutting it off, Amy. Lovely performance. I assume that was live. I think I heard some audience sound.
Yeah.
Is that how you prefer?
That's how I roll. And you know what? I always tell everyone, I will make a mistake. And all human error is forgivable. So I perform in a way that's almost like a postseason baseball pitcher, where whatever happens in that hand is going to direct that pitch to the batter in a very different way than what's coming out of the hand, right? So what I have to do is be the flutist that I am on the stage. And so if I can rein in my confidence and concentration and do that thing that athletes do and hear what I'm playing before I do it and see what I'm doing before I do it, it's going to work well for me out in the audience. So performing is not for everyone. And I only put up the live performances for the students if they're high quality. And if they have a blip in them, that's okay. And you know what? They forgive me too.
Well, let's circle back around to
the
imagination, powerful images being the focus of this program. Role of imagination in being an artist, being on stage. It sounds like this is something your students come away with strongly after 4 years with you at U of M.
I don't just say, go look at a Monet painting. I ask them if they've ever eaten foie gras.
No, you encourage them, right?
I encourage them.
To bring their full rounded imaginative selves to each piece.
And original thought. And you know what? They surprise me. They absolutely, I have to say, as young people, they have so much creativity. And I think, wow, did I used to do that? Could I ever turn a phrase like that? So yeah, they're inspirational, my students. And I have to say, as a professor, I don't go to work. I actually just go work with people. I don't go to an office. I go to a studio. And in the morning when I tell my schedule to my family, I say I have to go see, Bryce and Maria and Erica or whoever I have to see. So it's not just the office hours or a list of students. It's each individual. And they've all gone on to do their own beautiful life, no matter what it is.
Yeah, these days they can actually opt for an amazing variety of projects.
Yes, including having a family and holding a job as a flutist, which is super important to many women.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes they enter different fields. I mean, I know I have a personal friend who is in your studio now, Elizabeth Schubkegel, who formed a Celtic-inspired group here in Kalamazoo a couple of years ago, and it really took off, and that side of her is something I'm sure she wouldn't want to give up necessarily.
Right. So this was an incredible conversation that I had with this young woman, Kalamazoo native, when she came to have a lesson with me. So inspirational to me in a very University of Michigan way. We are entrepreneurial driven, and that's not a singular thing. It's a team effort. So when I hear of an entrepreneurship team, like a side comment of, oh, by the way, I have a Celtic band, my ears lit up and my brain took off. And I said, so tell me about your concerts. So we've developed a program for her where she is, the first day of studio class, I told everyone they have to get on YouTube and every form of social media and make her famous. That is the number. That's
a
easy.
Team effort.
Now, the other thing with the flute is that she is supposed to work with her etudes and her scales very much, very, very much scales and etudes, because that is the heart of what she's doing, are these arpeggiated things. And if she's not keeping her facility warm and comfortable and flowing, she's not comfortable on stage, because she's also singing. She's also dressed. She's also working with her band. She's also, you know, fronting a band, and she doesn't have many backups. She's it. So I wanted to cultivate that in her. So she didn't need to play the Carmen Fantasy or the Mozart Concerto for me. And I knew that. And that's what Michigan is training me to think like.
Interesting. It's Aaron Dworkin, who's recently been appointed or became dean.
Right. And he needed to step aside for some family matters. So we have our beautiful acting undergraduate dean came in, Melody Racine, and she's filling in a third year. So but it's all just a beautiful effort at expanding the consciousness of the entrepreneur in music. So we have a business office downstairs called Excel. I call it the Make Your Dreams Come True office. EXCEL, and it's our program for anyone who wants to walk in and announce that they have a project, but you will be vetted quite extensively for your project, because you can't just say, oh, I think I want to do this. A lot of people say that. So I think Excel has been really the driving force for me to look and see how I can individually as a teacher work better on the lines of, you know, entrepreneurship in our country, arts in our country.
Martha, I'm getting the sense from Professor Porter here of what interacting for just one day with your students might be like, the kind of fires that might be lit.
Oh, yeah. The students here at Western are so motivated and so ready to work with you, Miss Amy. and they have ideas and crazy projects of their own, and that's one great privilege of working here. I get to work with students who are ambitious and motivated, and they're great humans too.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear their stories, and that's part of my teaching, is that I'll say, all right, what is your story behind this piece? And often I get silence, but quite often, and I hope here, that the Western Michigan University student will tell me their story and include us so that we can make it even more dramatic.
Well, let me bring the focus back to Professor Porter's, or Amy Porter's, performance tonight at 7:30 p.m. This is the public event that a lot of folks have been looking forward to. It begins at 7:30 p.m. in the Dalton Center Recital Hall at Western Michigan University. The program is called Powerful Images. Yulian Tay will be accompanying Dr. Porter, and begins with the Fantasy by Georges Hue. Then we hear Beyond the Forest, this folk-inflected piece by Mike Jumstrom. And then you give a famous two-flutist composer named Philippe Galbert some real attention here. I'd like to hear your history with Philippe Galbert, who, of course, died long before you were born. But
yes, Philippe Galbert was the Leonard Bernstein of Paris, I call him.
Interesting.
Flutist, educator, composer, just such a legend. But
conductor?
Conductor, yes, absolutely. So Philippe Galbert was actually the prized dissertation subject of Penelope Fisher. Dr. Penelope Fisher lives in Ann Arbor. And she's one of my founders of the Southeast Michigan Flute Association. She's a Service Award winner from the National Flute Association. I cannot say enough about Dr. Penelope Fisher. And this dissertation was going unread, unnoticed. So I decided to include her on a DVD. And I'm, you know, I love DVDs, making DVDs, because if I have to say something more than, oh, a few times, I'd rather just record it and then hand you a recording and then say, study this, come back, we'll get all that covered. So I've been doing study guides because you can't possibly cover the life and the compositions of one composer in 30 minutes or an hour. So I give historical commentary, and who better to bring to the video camera than Penny Fisher. So I said, Penny, may I please make a DVD about the life of Philippe Gobert? You will bring your treatise to it. We will hire one of the world's best pianists for flutists. He's from England. We brought him over, and my dream came true. I got a grant from the University of Michigan Office of Research, as well as a couple of sponsors through the flute world, including my Haynes Flute Company. So the ball was rolling. I went into Hill Auditorium and recorded all 16 works for flute and piano with Tim Carey, and then went into the studio a month later with Penny Fisher and got the dialogue down that we needed to tell about Philippe Gobert. And we begin the DVD in 1888 at the World's Fair. Gobert is 14, but Debussy is there. He's in his 20s. He's over there at the World's Fair in Paris, over there in the neighborhood of the where the Javanese were there and Balinese music, and he had heard
the Gamelan Orchestra.
Right, these amazing scales. New scales. So Debussy was very influenced. Maurice Ravel was 44. He was taking his incredible orchestrations from the piano into the orchestra. And Fauré was a big influence on Gobert. So Gobert was discovered quite literally by Jules Taffanel, the father of the famous Paul Taffanel, the pedagogue. He was literally walking by an open window and heard an amazing flute sound, and it was 14-year-old Philippe Gobert. Philippe Gobert was transported to Paris immediately. You play too well, you must be famous. So he became, by 15, he graduated with the superior prize. And then they without an audition, they put him with a baton and they put him in front of the student orchestra. He had never had any coachings, and he became this conductor. And then, okay, so then he succeeded Moïse. I'm sorry, he taught Moïse. He succeeded his teacher, Taffanel. So Moïse comes, and Moïse wins first prize on Gobert's piece, Nocturne in Allegro Scherzando. And so Moïse created this whole legacy, passed down from Gobert, passed down from Taffanel. Penny Fisher talks about the famous Taffanel-Gobert 17 daily exercises and how a court case almost ensued. It's a fun little drama involved with our famous Taffanel-Gobert. Penny Fisher is incredible on the study guide. So the study guide, the history portion hits the downloadable, hits the web this week. I've released about 7 works, and then we do the history. And now we go into post-World War I Gobert. Gobert served in World War I, most notably in the Battle of Verdun. And he was awarded the Medal of Honor for his services. And he went back to Paris, and he chose not to discuss it, as many war veterans did. And so he just went on and continued to conduct and compose. And it was just a prolific amount of works that he's written for the flute that have been unearthed. I have to say, I brought them in from many different libraries and many different publishers. And Carl Fischer Publishers have asked me to put together in my own edition all 16 works. So I've got a little more work to do.
Yeah.
Well, the hard copy
project.
Yeah. So I'll be playing tonight his rarely heard suite. And what's so beautiful about Gobert as a man is that he loved his friends, and he devoted or dedicated every single one of his pieces and a movement, even in the suite, to a friend. So we have Louis Fleury, Marcel Moïse, and Georges Barrère, the famous French flutist who moved to America and played in the New York City Symphony. So a lot of Gobert's works are dedicated to Georges Barrère. So Georges Barrère was my grand teacher. So it's just so beautiful to bring this project to the students. And I'll be playing the suite and then his very difficult sonatine.
From 1937, it says
here. From 1937, yeah.
And the music will be speaking for itself tonight, but it's so nice to get a little context this morning here on WMUK. And of course, for people who really are curious about his life, there will soon be released
the full history.
We have about just a few short minutes left in this hour, so I wanted to remind you again to talk about a new release coming out on the famous Naxos label.
Yes.
You mentioned Michael Dougherty earlier in the hour. This is a significant new flute concerto that he wrote for you, which you premiered and is now going to be available commercially.
Yes, March 2018, we can look forward to the release of Michael's new CD, and it will include the concerto that he wrote for me that I've been playing for the last 10 years, Trail of Tears, and it's on Naxos, and I'm really excited because Michael's been super popular, winning a lot of Grammy Awards, and if I can ride those coattails to the very end, my bucket list would be complete.
Any attention is good attention, oh. Yeah.
So, see you in March.
Did you have any final words, Martha, on this concert tonight?
You know, frankly, I'm just sitting here learning so much and feeling just absolutely so grateful that I get to learn from you, Miss Amy, frankly.
Oh,
and this woman is so intelligent, so inspiring, so tremendously artistically meaningful and imaginative. And it's just, I can't tell you how much it means to me that you're here, and I'm so thrilled to have you work with my students, but really just thankful for your friendship and that I can even, you know, call you a friend and a colleague. That's such an honor to me.
That's what flute players are.
Thank you for being here.
We'll go Broncos. Oh, my pleasure.
You're both very, very busy people who opportunities like this don't, I mean, they really have to be planned a lot in advance.
We did plan this.
But this is very exciting for you and for audiences as well. Again, the concert's at 7:30 tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Tickets at the door or by calling the Miller Auditorium box office, 387-2300.
And come say hello to me afterwards.
Absolutely. I'm in the background. I've already started this little bit of the Caliendo Western Sonata.
Great.
So we'll let it play us into the news. And of course, the full performance is tonight. And this is, if you didn't hear it earlier in the hour, the Western Sonata
yeah.
by Christopher Caliendo.